A very busy show and a fun one on Thursday, October 21st, 2021 on Connecticut Today. We chatted with former Connecticut U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman about his new book, The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. Shelton GOP State Rep Jason Perillo checked back in with us to update the redistricting process in the state. And Quinnipiac University Law Professor Bill Dunlop took a look at two qualified immunity cases that came before the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us right now is a gentleman that needs to be heard, I think. His new book, The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. I used to speak to this gentleman on a fairly regular basis, been a few years right now. Former Connecticut U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman on the show. Joe, it's Paul here. How are you? It's been too long.
Hey, Paul, it's really great to hear your voice and to get to talk to you again. I'm good, and really good, and I hope you are too. Thank God.
Yes, life is good, Senator. With everything going on, I treasure each day, honestly, that I just get out of, right?
No. It's taught us a lesson. We always should do that, but when there's as much suffering and uncertainty around you, you really do appreciate the gift of life every day, and you try to make the most of it. So I'm just very happy to be talking to you again, Paul. A familiar voice and person.
Well, thanks.
I hope you're doing well.
I appreciate that. I am. The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. You know, I was looking over the materials of this senator and thinking back to, you know, when we used to talk on a regular basis, and it wasn't all that long ago, but boy, I got to tell you, Joe, the temperature in D.C. now, I mean, it hasn't been all that long in years, but the shift from a tone and from a policy point of view, it might as well have been 100 years. It must really frustrate you, and I'm guessing that's why you wrote this book.
You are absolutely right. I mean, there's obviously a big problem in Washington, and it seems to be getting worse, which is hyper-partisanship, mistrust. Political parties tend to treat each other as if they were enemy nations instead of fellow Americans who happen to have a different point of view. So we got a problem, and the problem is that our government is not working for us. And I offer in this book what I call the centrist solution, which is the way during my 24 years in the Senate government worked, which is that people who were liberal or conservative, Republican or Democrat, independent or moderate, came to the center and talked to each other about the problem America had and talked about ways we might fix it and what we could agree on. We compromised and we got it done. And incidentally, that's the way America has always made progress, going way back to the Constitutional Convention, where there were big disagreements, but they resolved them because they had a higher goal, which was to declare their independence from Great Britain. And obviously, we should still have a higher goal, which is to serve the country and the people who were good enough to elect us. So that's why I offer the solution from my own life in American history to the problems we have, and I call it centrism. It's not moderation. That's different. That's an ideology. Centrism is a strategy for working together to make our government work again for the people.
And I remember you used to tell me, and a bunch of other people I've interviewed in Congress, I had a former congressman, David Jolly, a Republican from Florida, on a couple of weeks ago about an organization he's involved in. But, Joe, I remember you always used to say that when you went into a negotiation with somebody of the other party, you knew you weren't going to get everything, but there were goals that you figured, hey, if we could agree on this, that's a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the masters at this was Ted Kennedy. Now, Teddy was a real liberal Democrat, but when he wanted to get something done, he could really be a centrist. And he had agreements that he made with a lot of conservative Republicans like Orrin Hatch, Mike Enzi, and they produced really good results for the people. And Kennedy did something that in any negotiation I've been in is the way it works. But he made it almost into a system, which is he would say to the Republicans on the committee or the ranking Republican, okay, let's make a list of all the issues on this big bill, and let's divide them into three categories. One category is the things we agree on now, we could adopt right now. The second are parts of the bill that we will never agree on, so let's just forget them for now. Come back another day. And in the middle, there's a bunch of things that we might agree on. Let's negotiate. Let's see if we can compromise and pass something. And by and large, as a result, he usually got at least 50% of what he wanted, and the other side thought it got at least 50% of what it wanted. And the big beneficiary, of course, was the country, because something good was adopted with bipartisan support.
Senator, let me ask you what you think of the Democratic Party right now. You know, I'm on this show 5 days a week, 2 to 6, and my head's been exploding, Senator. I'm saying, you know, you've got this infrastructure bill that pretty much, you know, a lot of people agree on. You know, just pass this thing. Show America you can get something done. But, man, the horse trading, just among Democrats. I mean, the Republicans are just kind of sitting back and eating popcorn on this thing. That's got to frustrate you when you see that, or not. You tell me.
Oh, no, very frustrating, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, one of the things that I've done since I left the Senate in 2013 was to become chair of a group that existed before called No Labels, meaning forget the label Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative. We're all Americans. Let's figure out how to work together in the center. And No Labels really worked with bipartisan groups in the House and Senate to write this infrastructure reform bill, the bipartisan one. And it passed the Senate in this hyperpartisan era with 69 votes, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell voting for it. So it went to the House, and then the so-called progressive caucus in the House, Democratic caucus, really people not just center-left but further-left, said, oh, no, we're not going to deal with this until you agree to pass our $3.5 trillion social service new entitlement program. And they're at gridlock now, although President Biden finally came in and trying to negotiate it. But my organization and I kept saying, get the bipartisan infrastructure bill done. It's not only going to be really good for the country and better roads and bridges and a lot of and train transportation, mass transit, but it's going to prove to the country that the people we elected to Washington, Congress and the presidency, are still able to work together for the good of the country. And right now it's being blocked. It seems like they're working something out, but you know, as Yogi said, it ain't over till it's over, and it shouldn't have come this far. They should have adopted the bipartisan infrastructure bill in the House, sent it to the president. He would have signed it. He worked on it in the Senate, and it would have been a big accomplishment for our country and, frankly, for President Biden himself. But the left of his own party stopped him for now from that accomplishment.
You tell a lot of great stories, Senator, I know, in the book. And finally, I wanted to wrap up with this one, or have you tell us, and this is one of the big stories that is making the early rounds here in the reviews of the book, which I see are generally good. The run you had against a guy named Ned Lamont, I hear he went on to other things, but
yeah, what happened to him, Paul?
You got a phone call after that primary that kind of surprised you. Tell us about that.
I did. And let me just say to you and folks who are listening, you've looked at the book. I mean, because my whole career was based in Connecticut, there are a lot of stories in it about Connecticut politics and Connecticut personalities, which I think people in Connecticut will really enjoy reading. And if there are a few names in there like Ella Grasso that the younger people don't recognize, you should know what a great, great person she was, and to me, a mentor, a teacher. Okay, so 2006, I'm up for re-election to the Senate for my fourth term. I have separated from my party on the question of whether we should retreat from Iraq in defeat, which I thought would have been a terrible blow to our credibility in the world and our security here at home. So the Democratic Party had put in an amendment to defund the military. I mean, it's about as ridiculous as defunding the police, which people have been talking about lately.
Mm-hmm.
So I opposed it. And on one vote, I was the deciding vote. Anyway, on the basis of that, pretty much, only that, I got challenged in a primary. And I lost, but I was lucky enough in Connecticut that I could run as an independent, which I did. And God bless the people of Connecticut. I won with support from all three parties. But let me go back. It's primary day. I'm up at the Goodwin Hotel in Hartford, and that's where we're going to get the returns. The phone rings. Somebody on my staff picks it up. It looks almost like the call has been from a ghost. and she says, they say it's Karl Rove at the White House. So, you know, Karl Rove was President Bush's number one political guy. So I knew him some. I picked it up. How's it going? He says. Well, I said, it's going to be close, Carl. He said, yeah, that's what we hear. The boss asked me to call you, and he didn't say the name, but I knew who the boss was. That boss asked me to call you and tell you that if you lose this primary, he really urges you to run as an independent because the country needs you in the Senate, and he knows that it's only because you stood up for our troops in Iraq that you got this primary, and you don't deserve it. So he wants you to know that if you run as an independent, we'll help you in any way we can. Well, I was startled. I said, well, thanks, Carl. I can't thank you enough. Frankly, I hung up the phone. He wished me well. I had no idea what he was talking about. And lo and behold, in the following days, people called, some of whom I knew, some of whom I didn't, said, you know, we want to raise money for you. We were asked by either Karl Rove or the Bush White House. And the Republican Party in Connecticut really laid back, you know. Now, part of that was that I was friendly with Governor Rell, and like Chris Shays was my dear buddy. He actually endorsed me that year, congressman from Fairfield County.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it, I think, was that the Bush White House told him, don't go out of your way to defeat Lieberman. And what can you say? I mean, I did something that was nonpartisan, and I got unexpected help from a totally nonpartisan source in this case, which was the Republican president of the United States. I'll never forget it. It was quite a story.
Amazing stuff. Name of the book, The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. Former Connecticut U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman. Senator, great to talk with you. Good luck on the book, and have your people get a hold of me, your PR people, your staff, and if you're in the area, in the Bridgeport, Milford, Fairfield County area, we'll have you in the studio and we can spend a bit longer. So the next time, hopefully we'll do that.
I would love to do that, Paul. It's great to talk to you. God bless you. Be well.
All right, Joe, be good. Thank you. Former Connecticut U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman. Yes, Bridgeport, Fairfield, Westport, Weston, Ansonia, Shelton, Derby, every city or town in Connecticut is in a congressional district, in some sort of a state house district or state senate district. We just had the 2020 census. The numbers delayed a bit because of COVID-19. So now a group of legislators, as you know, they're trying to parse out where the population shifts were to make sure that the state Senate and House districts and the Congress districts are as close as they can be to equal representation. One of those doing this, we've chatted with him on this before, getting a little progress update. Shelton GOP State Rep Jason Perillo is with us. Jason, hi. It's Paul again at WICC. How are you?
Great, Paul. How are you?
Good. So I'm reading there is progress being made here, and I know was there an addition, did I read, Jason, to the group of you folks trying to figure this whole thing out?
That's correct, actually. So we have now become a commission, which is what's required in the state constitution, and the eight individuals from the legislature then vote to appoint a ninth member. In this case, we did that the other day, and Kevin Johnston, former Democratic state representative, former Democratic auditor of public accounts, will be serving in that role. He is extremely highly regarded. Obviously, the most important thing is to get somebody in that role who is, you know, just trustworthy and honest, and we've done that with that choice, and that choice was unanimous among all eight members.
So now you've been at this, Jason, you and the other members, for a few months. And the last time we talked was a couple of days before a deadline. And we all know that there weren't going to be huge changes here. But nonetheless, as you illustrated to me back then, it is kind of a daunting task, is it not, to make sure that all these House and Senate districts and the congressional districts are kind of equal here in representation. How would you summarize your progress, Jason, toward that so far?
Well, you know, actually, believe it or not, we're making very good progress. I feel like I'm going blind staring at maps every day.
You must know where every street in Connecticut is right around now, right?
I can get anywhere at this point, Paul. I can drive anywhere. But it's just so important that the districts be right-sized. And, you know, the software we use helps with that process. But you want to get it right. So we don't rush through these things. We take it very, very seriously. You know, we've had some significant growth shifts. We've seen a lot of growth in Fairfield County, in Bridgeport, in Stamford, in Norwalk. A lot of those towns have grown. Shelton, for example, has grown. And in other parts of the state, basically east of the Connecticut River, we've seen a decline. So that really starts to impact how we draw the lines, where districts are, whether there need to be new districts created in part of the state and eliminated in another part of the state, all of that sort of remains to be seen. But all options really are on the table at this point. We're just trying to be as fastidious as we can to make sure we do it right and we do it fairly.
Shelton GOP Rep. Jason Perillo with us for a few more minutes talking about the redistricting process. He is part of that. Yeah, and I know you mentioned this to me previously, Jason, and others have as well. There are objective things that you folks look at, the raw numbers. Okay, we move this street over to this district. Let's run the numbers again. What does it look like? But then again, I guess you said to me before, there are subjective things here. Like, for example, how do we keep, say, if there is a neighborhood or areas of deep ethnicity, for example, keep them together so their concerns are heard?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly try to do that. And you really try to understand, you know, as members of the commission, we try to understand the nuances of every single district, and in many cases, to your point, Paul, every single neighborhood. You know, we want to keep as many districts as we can, keep them condensed and compact. We don't like really ugly looking districts that curl around and up, down, and sideways. You know, we try to, you know, have situations where we're not, you know, crossing rivers where there's no bridge. We want the community to be together, the district to be together, mm-hmm. And we take those things into consideration. And, you know, sometimes you're working on a district and you think you got it figured out, and then you realize, oh, no, that's not going to work because we really put a couple things together that just don't make sense. You know, you try not to divide municipalities when you don't have to. So there's a lot of levers to pull. There's a lot of there's a lot of places where you can make mistakes. So we try to minimize those as much as possible.
You mentioned a couple of seconds ago, Jason, you alluded to software programs, computers helping, and I know online they've actually posted the links. There are two or three links where they say, like in the Mirror and the Connecticut News Junkie, here, go ahead, you try it. How helpful are these to run ideas? Are these software packages or these algorithms? Do you find them helpful?
They are very helpful, but in some cases they're really frustrating. And I'll tell you why.
Sure.
So we're able to pull in population into a district or out of a district by census block. And if you didn't know any better, you'd think all the census blocks have about the same number of people in it. Not true. You may want to grab one little street because it makes sense to include it in the district. And you need to add population to one district. And you go click on that street, and it's part of a census block with 1,000 people. And in another part of the state, you may click on that street, a different street, and it's a census block with 12 people. So, you know, you try to make things right, and then you realize, gosh, it's just so hard because these census blocks are drawn in such a nonsensical way. And I'm sure there's a reason for it. I certainly don't know what it is. But, you know, you sort of work within the confines of the data you're given and the way the blocks are drawn and come up with the best product you can.
Jason, thanks for the update here. We appreciate it. I know this all then has to get introduced to the House and Senate, so we'll see how that shakes out. Jason Perillo, State Rep, Republican Shelton, one of the members of a select commission that will try and make sure that the House districts, the Senate districts, and the U.S. House districts are all equal, as best they can be, after the census. Jason, good to speak with you. Have a good weekend. We'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Always a pleasure.
Appreciate it. State Rep Jason Perillo there from Cheshire. He and eight other people now. It's a nine-member commission. There is a chair, four Democrats, four Republicans, and they have to sit there and figure out with the population shifts. Look, Connecticut's not going to lose or gain a House seat. There wasn't as much of a shift there. So there are still going to be five congressional districts. Now, what those districts will look like, remember, you've got five districts and, what, 3.4 million people? So each district has to contain roughly close to 700,000 people. And they've got to make those five districts work out. 36 state Senate districts. So again, that's kind of easy. You can do that in your head. So each state Senate district needs about 100,000 people to be equal. The state House is a little more tricky. You've got 151 House districts, big cities there, but each district that they've got to figure out, it's got to be 22, 23, 25,000, something like that. So once again, thanks to Jason Perillo, Republican state rep from Shelton. Something kind of interesting popped on the news wires the other day. We talk about this theory of qualified immunity, that being a police officer, a man or woman entrusted with policing areas, sometimes things get a little excessive and you have to use force or other means to corral a suspect. Of course, Connecticut has, in the minds of some people, eroded that away. Other people say, no, this is just protection here so people's rights aren't violated, whatever. But the Supreme Court sided with a couple of police officers in a couple of qualified immunity cases. And this came out a few days ago. Our legal, Quinnipiac University law professor Bill Dunlap joins us to talk about this. Bill, good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing just fine. How are you, Paul?
I'm good, Bill. I'm good, and thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you on this chiming in. So what do you think, Bill? I saw these two cases come down, and I said, well, this is kind of interesting, and I read the particulars here. Anything you think we can read into this, Bill, by the fact that a couple of police officers were cleared or not further pushed in these cases?
Yeah, I think we can read something into it on the federal level. In terms of the Connecticut approach to governmental immunity, I don't think this is going to have much to do with it. But there were some indications last year that the Supreme Court was going to start backing off this idea of qualified immunity, which allows police officers in most cases to avoid being sued when they're accused of using unnecessary or unreasonable force. A couple of cases last year suggested that the Supreme Court was going to make it easier for plaintiffs to come into federal court and sue. But these two cases that came down last week suggest that maybe the court's not heading in that direction, and that it is backing up the 40 or 50 year old rule that says you have to prove that the police violated a law that was absolutely clear to them at the time that they committed the alleged violation.
And I guess one bill here is a domestic violence call where the gentleman in question here came out. I guess he claims that he was going to surrender, yet one of the officers apparently put a knee on this person's neck. There was a knife involved, and this whole thing was about 8 seconds. So I guess that's where this guy said, hey, that was excessive force. I was giving up here.
That's exactly right. Excuse me. And the trial court agreed. He won a case in federal court, and the judgment was upheld by the Court of Appeals. And the Supreme Court took that case and the other one you're probably going to mention and reversed it and said, nope, they should not have allowed that case to be brought.
And the other one here, you have again what appears to be a domestic case here, Bill, out of Oklahoma, a 911 call. We see these cases all the time. Police show up. The woman, the man is there. You can kind of tell something's going to happen here. There's body cam footage of one guy talking with officers as he goes back to an area where he had tools hanging. He grabs a hammer, and the officers tell him to drop it. They encounter him. So, again, Bill, it does seem here that a lot of these cases, or at least these here, often pop up in very tense situations that, you know, aren't always dealt to the point where, you know, officers can sit back kind of and decide, well, what are my options here?
Right. That's exactly what virtually all of these cases are about, where tensions got so high or things moved so fast that the police got involved in a use of force that some people looking at the time or some people looking back at it afterwards said was unnecessary. So one of the functions of the qualified immunity doctrine is to say that unless there was a situation which the police officer recognized at the time as being a constitutional violation, he should not be allowed to be sued at all. I have heard some criticism of these two cases that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the facts that you were just describing, it's easy to be very sympathetic to the police officer. And yet the juries or the courts at the trial level did not do that. And I've heard some suggestions that the Supreme Court may be looking not so much at the doctrine of qualified immunity, but looking at the facts of this particular case and thinking, although not reasoning this way, not putting it on paper, but thinking, I'm not sure that this was such misbehavior by the police officer. And so let's just get rid of this case using this very broad doctrine of qualified immunity to do it.
And is that why, Bill Dunlap, that no justices publicly dissented here? Because I read that and I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Is that why you think there was no public dissent?
That could very well be. This was an unsigned opinion. Most of the opinions we see from the Supreme Court are written by one particular justice, and then some will sign on to it, others will dissent. But occasionally, in a more pro forma way, the court will simply issue an opinion, and we don't know how many people on the court agreed with this. And for those who may have disagreed, we don't know why. So it makes it harder to read into a doctrine like this what the court's doing when it does it without all the details that it usually goes into.
So finally, Billy, is there a fear then? Is this, you know, kind of beyond what you said? Is there a fear then that maybe the justices don't want to get specific here? Because, I don't know, do they not want to open up a legal can of worms? Do they not want to be targeted? Is a case really too messy to get specific on? I find that interesting that you say, and I have read about these unsigned opinions. That's always fascinated me.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's what's going on here. It's just some, you know, conversation I've heard in the background. But in terms of qualified immunity, the courts have not been afraid to deal with this in the past. This doctrine is a doctrine that was created by the courts in an effort to protect government officials generally, not just police officers, but federal officials generally, have the benefit of this doctrine. And the idea is that it allows them to go ahead with their business, doing what they think they need to do without having to second guess themselves and say, am I going to get myself sued if I go ahead with this? So the doctrine is there for a reason, but it has gotten broader in recent years, and it's come under enormous criticism because it does prevent people who probably do deserve some sort of compensation for unconstitutional injuries they receive, but who simply can't do it because they cannot prove that the rule, they cannot prove that the incident that occurred to them was clearly in advance found to be unconstitutional.
As always, thank you. Straightening it out for folks to understand it. Quinnipiac University Law Professor Bill Dunlop on a couple things the Supreme Court did or did not do. Bill, as always, thank you. Have a great weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. All right, there you go. Interesting stuff there. So unsigned opinions by the U.S. Supreme Court saying that at least in these two cases, the concept of qualified immunity, one of the cases being that a police officer who was trying to cuff a guy who had threatened his wife and child with a knife, that officer put a knee in the back of the suspect for 8 seconds, and that resulted in a lawsuit. Fascinating stuff.